There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Horticulture Week podcast. I'm Rachel Forsyth, senior reporter at Hort Week, and this week I'm joined by Richard Barley, director of gardens at Kew. Hi, Richard.
Hello there. Hi, Rachel.
And Bex Lane, Arboretum Supervisor. Hi, Bex.
Hi, Rachel.
Thank you so much for being on here, both of you. How are you both?
Well, I'm very well, thank you. How are you, Bex?
I'm very well. I've just come back from a little holiday in Spain, so I'm feeling well rested.
Lovely. Catching some rays.
Catching some rays and looking at some Mediterranean plants.
Will we see any of those at Kew? Was it kind of a research trip?
No. It was very much a holiday, but I did take some time to look at some plants in the wild because it just always informs best practice.
Yeah, you kind of can't help yourself, can you?
I can't, no, exactly.
Brilliant. So how long have each of you worked at Kew? Bex, do you want to start?
I have been here 7 years, I think. I started as a volunteer. I did a diploma and then worked in the gardens and then moved over to the Arboretum more recently.
Amazing. So what were you doing before the volunteering?
I was working in the charity sector. And before that, I was studying architecture. So quite a varied background. But I'm very interested in landscapes and people. So Kew really does fit the bill there.
Yeah, and architecture, landscape architecture, you know, kind of
exactly.
Hand in hand.
Yeah.
Richard, what about yourself? How long have you been at Kew?
Just coming up to my 10th anniversary at Kew in early August. I will have been here 10 years. So previously I worked for 30 years with the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne and then for 3 years with an organisation called Open Gardens Australia, which is, I guess, the Australian equivalent of the National Garden Scheme. So, I've been here 10 years and it's been a very busy decade, I can tell you.
Yeah, absolutely. So have you always worked in the garden sphere?
Pretty much. Actually, almost completely, although in my early years with the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, the work was actually mostly out in the bush, but based back at the gardens doing some sort of analysis and things of a vegetation survey.
Yeah. So you said there it's been quite the 10 years. How have the gardens changed over those years?
Oh, gosh. I'll give you my version and then Bex can give you hers perhaps.
Yeah.
It's been a 10 years in which we have set out to, I guess, reinvigorate parts of the gardens to introduce some new horticultural development, things such as the Great Broadwalk Borders, the Children's Garden, the Ages Evolution Garden, the Kitchen Garden, Winter Garden, as examples. So really investing in lifting the not just the diversity but also the quality of horticulture across the site. In addition, of course, we've restored the magnificent Temperate House, the world's largest still existing Victorian glasshouse. So we've sort of rolled up our sleeves and got on with a few quite challenging projects along the way. So I think for the visitor coming to Kew who's familiar with the site, what they might say now compared to 10 years ago, I hope, is that there's a bit more obvious horticulture and there's perhaps a bit more of an eye for design within the site. What do you think, Bex?
Yeah, I would thoroughly agree. And I think it's been exciting because also we've made some changes to the culture in terms of giving more autonomy to people within the eye view of improving design. And I think that's made a really a big difference to how people are looking after their areas, and sort of the drive within the teams has really improved as a result of that. But I came on board as the volunteer for the Great Broadwalk Borders as they were being started, and that was really, really exciting to see that start. And to be, I just remember being completely thrilled at being able to plant on such an iconic sort of landscape and being allowed to play with the plants. It was amazing. So, yeah, so all of those projects have really made a huge difference to Kew.
Yeah, and that's what you want volunteers to get, right, from doing those kinds of jobs. You want to ignite that passion a bit more.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I mean, it worked. I'm still here.
Yeah, exactly. So moving to kind of today, what are your roles and what do you kind of get up to day to day?
On a day to day basis, I oversee four main areas: the Berberisdell, which also has a winter garden, a new winter garden attached to it; the Rosa Species Collection, which is actually one of the largest Rosa Species collections, however it's quite elderly, and we're looking at redesigning that at the moment; the Mediterranean Garden, and its extension, which I believe you've seen a little bit of, Rachel.
Yes,
and
I did.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't see you that day. But yeah, so that's quite exciting. And then the Capfoliaceae, Oleaceae, Adoxaceae beds, which is a sort of a central route through the gardens.
Amazing. So not that busy, really.
No, not at all. I had time to go on holiday, so it's all fine.
Richard, what about yourself?
Well, I guess, Rachel, my role as Director of Gardens, I have responsibility broadly for all of the horticulture and living collections, but also all of our learning and participation, staff and programs, our interpretation, garden design, volunteers, a breadth of things. And in addition to that, again, broadly, the responsibility for the Wakehurst site, although all of these departments and places have very capable people working within them. So So my job is often just getting out of the way and not causing trouble. I guess, you know, setting the longer term goals and just finding ways to achieve them is a lot of what I do.
Yeah, and we'll touch upon some of that and also some of the things you mentioned, Bex, like, you know, the Mediterranean extension in a little bit. But I wanted to touch upon firstly your recent plant healthy certification. Congratulations, first off. You're the third garden in the UK to receive that. What was the process to receiving that?
So that involved obviously quite a bit of filling in forms. It involved some sort of site assessment and auditing and just ensuring that we meet all the criteria as set out under the plant healthy scheme. Mm. I mean, the thing to say about it is, and why we felt it was worth going to that trouble and following through on the process, is that plant health and biosecurity broadly are incredibly important for this country and in fact, of course, for any country, because the risk and cost that arises from accidental introduction of pathogens, of pests, diseases, as everyone knows, can be horrendous. But not only sort of monetary cost, but cost to the landscape. If you think of the loss of most of the elms in the 1970s, if you think of the hundreds of thousands of ash trees needing to be felled currently because of ash dieback, not to mention the various other things, oak recessionary moth, whatever it might be, that's come into the country, often just through sometimes inattention to you know, not looking closely enough in inspecting plants or not being aware that a threat exists.
Yeah.
So biosecurity we are really, really focused on, and we need to be, obviously, because our collections are hugely important, but also as we feel it's our responsibility to set that example for other organisations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any benefits to you as an organisation to have that plant healthy certification? Like, will it help your work moving forward? Or
it's probably a little like a quality standard. You know, it's one of those things like an ISO certification, which just verifies that actually we have our house in order. We are doing the things we should be doing. We're We're growing healthy plants. We're covering off all the bases around good practice in terms of everything from our nurseries to our plant retail and so forth. So again, it's about it's a health tick, if you like. It's a thing that is important for an organisation such as ours to have.
I think on one level it helps us also, to helps us to communicate with the public in terms of what we think is acceptable and isn't acceptable. And it helps give a garden staff on the ground a language to say, oh, no, actually, sorry, you can't take a cutting of that plant or whatever it is, or bring a plant from the garden centre through the gardens because of biosecurity, and being able to actually describe to people, because I think that the general public largely don't think about it at all, and it's really helpful for us to have that reinforced so that we can chat to them about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that it also adds more value to what we do as an industry? You know, it's not just as simple as just growing plants.
To some degree, yes. I mean, I think, particularly post-Brexit, and I don't want to sort of get into the nitty-gritty of the world of the UK post-Brexit, except to say that there's huge opportunity, I think, for the nursery industry within Britain to really step forward in terms of growing and supplying healthy plants, which previously perhaps people might have imported in bulk from Europe. So I know people are all across those issues. So, again, being able to verify that any place that's involved with plant growing or selling or garden meets the criteria for biosecurity and plant health is really important.
And are you guys growing the majority of your plants? You aren't importing too much or exporting?
No, we're not. We occasionally have brought in material in the past. Mostly it's specific trees we've occasionally brought in from Europe for particular projects. And when we've done that, usually those trees will be quarantined away from this site for 12 months, and during that time they'll be inspected regularly for any signs of any pest or disease. But we don't actually do it terribly often. The nature of botanic gardens is we do grow incredibly diverse collections of plants, and the source of a lot of that stock is other countries. And so the material arrives perhaps as seed, possibly as cutting material and what have you. And all of that is done under very strict protocols in terms of collecting permissions and CITES permits and so forth. So we do have a fairly heavy administrative burden for anything we bring into the country, but absolutely, again, we're very rigorous with all of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask about CITES because some people have been experiencing issues around that, severe delays, plants being destroyed, things like that. Have you guys had any challenges around it?
Well, not specifically. I mean, the laws are the laws, and one just needs to be aware of what those laws are and to follow the processes. So we obviously do that. We do provide scientific advice to CITES as well on plant related matters. So it's quite a big responsibility for us.
Absolutely. So climate change is at the forefront of a lot of people's minds, especially public gardens, especially those who have heritage or rare collections to conserve. So what exactly is Kew doing to future-proof its collections? And I wonder how the glass houses play into that. Does that mean you have a little bit more of a safety net, so to speak?
As you said, Rachel, we do have a lot of our plant material under glass, and we have 5 public display houses. We have 3 nurseries on site here. We also have glass material under glass at Waker. So the point being that for that material, we can control the growing environment, be it tropical plants in the palm house or arid material or whatever it is, we can manipulate those environments. So broadly, the challenges relating to the changing climate are for our outdoor collections, and particularly for the longer-lived stock. So we're talking about trees primarily and longer-lived shrubs. And we've been undertaking quite a lot of research using some available assessment tools, looking at the future climate for London, for this part of London, and looking at how suited our trees and shrubs are for that future climate, looking at 2050 and 2090 or 2100, and then assessing for each of the trees and shrubs we have, whether it's more likely or less likely to be suited to that future climate. And what we've found is that, I mean, we have about 11,500 trees on site, for example. We know from our analysis of the data that by 2050, approximately a quarter of what we're growing currently will be out of its range of comfortable growing conditions. So some of those will be marginal, some will be definitely just struggling, if not dead. So that gives us a really strong indicator. It sort of points at which parts of the gardens, which particular trees we need to start thinking about in terms of replacement. We know what sort of landscape style we have and what we, you know, the things that are important to preserve. So our sort of our gaze shifts to parts of the world which have conditions that are better matched to the future climate in this part of the country, and that's where we look to find species that we can substitute into the landscape for the future rather than keeping on growing some of those or replacing some of the species from the past that are not necessarily well suited. So it's actually a really fundamental and important bit of research and then decision making, and one that of course we're also sharing with other gardens and arboreta around the country, because it's important that everyone understands these issues. And you know, there's nothing special about this site except, you know, we have a more diverse collection, but you know the issues will be the same for anyone growing trees and shrubs around the country.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a big topic at the moment. Bex, are you able to talk through some of those plants or trees in particular that will suffer and maybe those that are going to do really well?
So we can see in the plants that we're growing, so in the viburnum collection, in the Adoxaceae, Caprifoliaceae, Oleaceae, obviously a lot of the Oleaceae are doing really well. A lot of them come from the Mediterranean climate. The viburnums have been struggling for several years now, and we don't seem to be able to get enough water on them for long enough to really keep them thriving. We're keeping them ticking over, but many of them aren't. Obviously, there are some that, like Viburnum tinus, that do come from Mediterranean regions and are doing quite well. But we are seeing some losses there. We're very lucky, obviously, that we have the nursery and that they're propping anything that's looking a bit unhealthy, and then they're keeping them cosseted. So we're not losing collections, but we are thinking about what we're planting out and how we might change that. Also at Kew, we have a very sandy soil because we're on the floodplain, essentially. And that makes a big difference as well. I mean, that just increases the tendency for things to be stressed by the drought. And that works in two ways. And so on one hand, that is going to compound the issue for us. But on the other hand, when we're looking at extending the Mediterranean garden and growing a larger collection of Mediterranean plants, that free draining soil means that we're not going to be worrying so much about waterlogged roots over the winter. So,
right. Gives with one hand and takes away with another.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I was going to touch upon that expansion of the Mediterranean garden. How much are you expanding it by, and what kind of, are you bringing in new plants that aren't there at the moment, or are you just expanding what's there already?
Yeah, we're bringing in some new plants. So the original collection started as part of a festival where there are gardens from different areas of the world, and the Mediterranean garden was popped in 2007, I believe. Then a lot of that was, as Richard said, some of that was brought in from Italy, some of the trees for that collection. But then over time, they were replaced with natural source material that was collected by our colleagues. The main section of the Mediterranean basin of the Mediterranean garden is natural source, is one of the largest collections of natural source material in Kew, which is really nice. And that has been a gradual process, but it was originally planted up with plants from Asia, and and the back of the mound was planted up with some of Wilson's collections of rhododendrons. And they didn't like that sandy slope, which lends itself much more to the med climate. So that back section, the back of the mound, for anyone who doesn't know the topography, the Med Garden goes up one side of a man-made hill, which has King William's Temple of Folly on the top, and then back down onto a vista on the other side. And it's that backside of the temple that we are turning into the Mediterranean extension, so including South Africa, Chile, Western Australia, mustn't forget Australia when the boss is listening, and and California as well. Yeah, it was nearly really embarrassing there. So that's nice, and it is a really lovely site for that because it is a slope and it is sandy, so we are hoping that we will be able to get a lot of things growing really well. We have some stuff that we've grown from our nursery that are natural source collection. We have some stuff that we're bringing in to trial it. And if that goes well, then it's worth investing in bringing in some natural source material to, support the diversity of our collections more.
Yeah, yeah. How exciting.
Very exciting. It's looking really nice at the moment. It's enjoyed the early sunshine that we had in the beginning of June. And we've got some really lovely flowers in the South African section at the moment. And lots of California poppies flowering, which are always glorious.
Yes, absolutely. Sounds great. I know that education is a huge part of what Kew does. It's very important to Kew. So I'm kind of interested to hear about how you educate the public about, the work that you're doing at Kew, but also some of these big issues that we've kind of touched upon, like climate change, but also what we do as an industry and kind of promoting that as well.
Sure. So I guess if I could just step in there and say broadly across the site and across both our sites, Kew and Wakehurst, we have various approaches to interpretation. Some of it is the traditional sort of signs, information panels and what have you. I guess what we're seeking to do is some of it is certainly saying, this is a X species and it comes from here or there, but we're trying to sort of put that into a bit of context and to, I guess, encourage people to think, so to build understanding of issues of biodiversity and the environment broadly, and encourage people to think about those things, think about the challenges that environments around the world are facing. But also, in addition to the on-site material, we have volunteer guides, for example, who lead walking tours around the site. We have a lot of digital material through our websites and social media and such. So there are quite a range of ways that visitors can access information about Kew, about our site, our history, our plant collections, about the environment, about threats, about conservation issues. We have various festivals throughout each year, starting off usually with the Orchid Festival, of course, in February, and usually we have a focus on a particular country for that festival. And that allows us to really dial up the sort of focus on the special nature of those countries. For example, the next one will focus on Madagascar, and we our scientists do a lot of work in Madagascar, and we actually have a permanent field station there. And Madagascar is a country that has very significant conservation challenges and significant poverty as well. So we are, I guess, through doing things like orchid festivals or other festivals and events, it allows us to sort of open the window to people to see beyond this site and to really tap into some of the wider understandings and wider global issues and hopefully build people's understanding, as I said, and also, where possible, provide people with some tools, with some sort of ability to make more informed choices or things that may have a beneficial effect on the world around them.
Bex, do you get a lot of people coming up to you and asking you questions if they see you in the garden?
Oh, an awful lot of questions get asked. Mostly, where's the loo? But once you've got over that, I've only been asked that once today. You get a really broad range of questions from visitors, and that really shows a broad range of knowledge in the general public. Some people really haven't even got the basic concept that we only exist on this planet while there are plants. Mm. And if we don't have plants, then we are no longer able to be on this planet. And other people come and ask you incredibly detailed questions, and you feel like it's your exams from your diploma all over again. But yeah, it's a really wide range of knowledge. And I think that's one of the real challenges for Kew, is knowing at what level to pitch our interpretation and information, because you don't want to patronise people. But equally, you do want to get that basic message across.
Well, it's an interesting point. The Association of Leading Visitor Attractions 2021 visitor figures for members, Kew came out as the second most visited attraction, and you'd seen a 61% increase in visitors compared to 2020. I'm just wondering if that's part of the strategy, is kind of increasing this visitor number, or is it more important to you to broaden the type of visitors that are coming to the garden? Or is it both?
Well, it's clearly both. So we've had some very strong visitation over the past few years. Our sort of at the peak was 2019, just pre-COVID, when we had a very strong year of visitation. I think we're up to about 2.4 million in that year, with a combination of reasons. We had the Chihuly glass sculptures, we opened the children's garden. Yeah, a range of things affecting visitation that year. And then, of course, like everywhere, we dropped into the COVID pandemic, and I mean, we had to close for about 10 weeks, I think it was. And then when we reopened, of course, it was partial. You know, we had glass houses closed and cafes closed and so on, as everyone did. So the figures of the last few years, all I'm saying is they were affected by COVID, but we are building back very strongly again in terms of overall visitation. And that's fabulous to see. And I must say, just looking around the last few weeks, it's really, really pleasing to see the numbers of school pupils back in the gardens, you know, of all ages. Particularly this past week, I think, because we're getting close to the end of the year, they seem to, you know, they sort of build up to a crescendo almost. But just seeing the sort of enjoyment of the site of those young people as they sort of discover things like walking into the palm house, into the, you know, the steamy tropics and experiencing those plants from the equator and the steamy jungles of South American place. I mean, it's great to see how that affects people. I think that's the point. But absolutely, diversity is another key thing. You know, we want to be here for all communities and for all people within the country, within the UK, and overseas visitors as well. We introduced just as a particular individual measure at the start of last year in January, we introduced a £1 entry ticket for anyone who was on welfare, on pension or credit or legacy benefits, because we felt that these may be people for whom the entry fee to Kew may be a barrier, and we've just been really encouraged with how many of those £1 tickets have been sold. And how many people have come in on that scheme over the past 18 months. So, and we understand other organisations are also picking up that particular model now and doing exactly the same thing.
Anecdotally, I think you can see a real increase in the diversity of people in the gardens. I think it wouldn't be unfair to say that when I first started, the large number of visitors were elder ladies. And the change is quite incredible to see. One thing I think that's really lovely, we've had a really great increase in school kids, and that's lovely. And seeing them enthused is something you hope you can spark something for life for them. But also we've seen a lot more of young people, sort of the 18 to 30 year olds. I see there's a big increase in that number. And again, as diverse as London is, are the people coming in now. And that's a really lovely thing to see. I think that's a real success.
Brilliant. So those are obviously key things that are going to be part of Kew's strategy moving forward. What else can we expect from Kew in the future?
Well, we're as I said, we're pretty busy. So we've got some big plans at the moment for a couple of quite significant projects. I should say right in front of us now and recently opened is the extension to the northern end of the Great Broadwalk borders. So we've added an extra 50 metres or so onto those borders, and particularly with featuring plants that are well suited to drier conditions, so more drought hardy stock at that northern end. So the matched double borders were, I think, and no one has ever proven me wrong when we say they're the longest matched borders, pair of borders in the world, if not the universe. They are now even longer. Not that we like to brag, but in terms of other things going on, the big project on the planning board at the moment is restoration of the palm house, and particularly focusing on taking that magnificent Victorian tropical conservatory and turning it into a carbon neutral tropical conservatory, which is quite a challenge. But buildings like that weren't built to be low carbon users, but we are grasping that challenge and looking at using sustainable heat sources and such things and ways of reducing heat loss from the structure itself. So all of that is in the planning phase at the moment. We're launching into a major fundraising campaign for which the Palm House is a really central part. And hopefully, indeed we are about to move into construction of a couple of smaller glass houses which will accommodate the stock from the Palm House while the work goes on in there in the coming years. So Palm House, carbon neutral Palm House, is one of the big projects on our drawing board, as is a new learning centre, which has been fully designed. It's a very sustainable design. It's passive house rated. It will allow us to accommodate all of our school programs. It'll have laboratories. It has an auditorium, and it's a really lovely bit of design. We have, by some measure, the world's biggest schools education program here at Kew, and in a normal year we get close to 100,000 pupils coming through our program. So having a purpose-built facility is the surprising thing is that we haven't had one up to this point, but we are very much looking forward to that going ahead again. We're fundraising for that. We've got about half the funding we need currently, and we're still looking for philanthropic support, looking for donations to allow us to proceed into construction there. So a couple of sort of infrastructure projects where we're doing work, or we've got work coming up to decarbonise the heating also for one or two of the other conservatories. But across the site, things, as Bex mentioned, the expansion of the Mediterranean garden is a really key thing. We'll continue to, redevelop areas, improve areas. We've got a plan for what we're calling a carbon garden, or possibly a climate change garden. We're still debating over the name of it. But it will be a garden where visitors can learn sort of what carbon is, where it can be found in the environment, how does it move around, you know, from photosynthesis through to carbon sequestration. What's the link with climate change? How does carbon affect the climate, and what can we do about, with nature-based solutions and things like that to slow the rate of climate change? So this will be done through a landscape development. It'll be just near the Princess of Wales Conservatory. It's in the planning phase at the moment, and we'll also be seeking to raise money to allow us to go ahead with that. It will be a beautiful landscape, I should say, as well.
No doubt.
Yeah, well, I think it's not always that easy, but I think one of our criteria for any of these things is that there needs to be beauty within it, because we need to be very careful about how we treat this very, very special landscape.
My last question for you both is, what plant would you take to a desert island? And I will say, it doesn't have to survive on the desert island. It's more of like a your favourite plant kind of thing, but a lot of people do like to give themselves that extra challenge and pick one that will also survive.
Over to you first, Bex.
I think I'd like to take an artichoke, because you can have artichokes in Spanish style, obviously still on holiday here in my head. Which is absolutely my favourite thing in the world to eat. The very young green artichoke heads. But you can also have cardo from the leaves, like the cardoon leaf, for the winter. And obviously the flower is stunning as well.
Great. I hear artichoke dips really good as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll be doing the full range of artichoke.
Great, I'll be coming to yours. Yeah. Richard, what about you?
Okay, now you did give us the out clause, which says that they don't necessarily have to be well suited to growing on a desert island. So I'm going to take that with both hands and say there is a rather lovely large eucalyptus tree that I'm looking at my window. It's Eucalyptus dalrympleana. And what it does, apart from being a beautiful tree to look at, it provides shade, which on the desert island I suspect may be quite handy.
Yeah.
The firewood is very, very good for cooking and just generally warming yourself. So it gives you firewood. And it's just it's just a beautiful tree to, you know, when the wind blows through it, it has a sound to it, and it, it's just a spectacular tree. So I rather think it would be a balm for my spirits if I was marooned on a desert island while I counted away the days until the rescue ship came along. Or if it didn't come along, I'd just enjoy sitting under the tree.
Perfect, perfect. One is kind of healing your spirit and soul, and one is looking after your stomach. I like the two.
I think my soul might be in my stomach.
I think mine is too. Yeah, that's so true. Well, thank you both so much for coming on. That's been so interesting to hear a bit more about what's going on at Kew and what you've kind of got planned for the future. Lots of really exciting things coming up, so we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure from this end of things. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm Rachel Forsyth, and this has been the Horticulture Week podcast. Make sure you never miss one. Subscribe or follow Horticulture Week podcast via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. If you are interested in producing a podcast with Horticulture Week, email us at hortweek@haymarket.com. Huge thank you again to Richard and Bex, and goodbye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.